Let's get this panel underway. I first got interested in the Black Sea region through my study of ancient Greek, believe it or not, because the ancient Greeks, of course, were great colonizers in the Black Sea. And that was the first time that I visited it as a university student. Of course, more recently, it's become a hot topic for the defense and national security community. And one prescient commentator described it as far back as 2011 as the danger zone in which the future relationship of Russia to the West is being worked out. And we're fortunate today to have three speakers who are supremely well qualified to introduce this discussion. We have Major General Leonardo Dino, who has recently retired, having been the Deputy Chief of Military Intelligence in the Romanian Army, amongst many other appointments in a distinguished career. And he's going to talk to us about the growing militarization of the Black Sea region and hybrid warfare in particular. He'll be followed by Professor Dungaciu, who is a professor at the Faculty of Sociology and Social Work at the University of Bucharest, as well as being director of the Institute of Political Sciences and International Relations of the Romanian Academy. And he's going to focus on frozen conflicts in the region and Russia's exploitation of those conflicts. And thirdly, we have Dr. Harlan Ullman, who has had a long and distinguished career, including in combat operations as a naval officer in Vietnam, but more recently as a strategic thinker, an advisor to governments around the world, really, the principal author of the doctrine of shock and awe. And I think he may touch on a new doctrine which he is has written about more recently, as he gives his views on the US perspective and what the US and its allies can bring to security in this region. So I pass the floor to you, Major General Leonardo Dino.
Thank you, sir. And good afternoon to all participants to this online conference. In the next 10 minutes or so, I would like to highlight the current regional context in conjunction with the excessive militarization process launched by Russia in Black Sea region. In this sense, I have prepared a presentation, which I hope will answer some of the issues of Russian strategy and geopolitics in the Black Sea region. I will ask Dave to start the presentation and to help me with technical support.
One minute, sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. And I start with a geopolitical assessment, according to which, throughout history, the conflicts and wars in this region have involved not only riparian states, but also major powers, leading to major changes of the strategic balance in Europe and beyond. Next slide. The Black Sea is one of the areas of maximum geostrategic interest for the Russian Federation due to the confluence of the main economic, trade, and transport routes of natural resources, too, and from the Middle East, North Africa, and Eurasia. Also, Moscow exerts political and military pressure on riparian states to limit NATO enlargement, infrastructure, and maneuver of the Allied forces, facilitates the access to the Mediterranean Sea and its warm water ports in order to counterbalance the US and NATO naval presence. And last, but not least, creates the premises for the expansion of Russia's exclusive economic zone and the access to new gas and oil resources in the Black Sea, but also facilitate the protection of its strategic gas pipelines from Russia to the southern Europe. Next one, please. Prolonged crises and frozen conflicts characterize the region from a security point of view, from Transnistria to in the Republic of Moldova, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, in the South Caucasus to Nagorno-Karabakh. These issues seem, at least on short term, to have no viable solutions. However, in this way, Moscow blocks and complicates, I can say almost renders impossible, the integration within the EU and NATO of the Republic of Moldova or Georgia. It turns Armenia into a state dependent on Russia for its security and puts pressure on Azerbaijan in order to limit its geopolitical options. After USSR dissolution in 1991, Black Sea didn't have the same geostrategic importance, but Russia permanently included in so-called concept of near abroad, and this only until emergence of colorful revolutions around Russia in Georgia and Ukraine, during which the desire to adhere to Euro-Atlantic values was publicly expressed. Also, in that period, Romania and Bulgaria joined NATO, changing the regional balance of power. Putin signaled his anger at the 2007 Munich Security Conference with a bellicose speech in which he railed against the post-Cold War international order and suggested that Russia was preparing to challenge it, but he already had done so. Please recall that just months before Putin's speech, Moscow agents assassinated Alexander Litvinenko in downtown London. Next slide. The security situation in the Black Sea region changed dramatically after 2008, when Russian military forces stationed in South Ossetia repelled Tbilisi military endeavor to regain the separatist region control, followed by Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the military intervention in eastern Ukraine. Even though Russia had victoriously come out of the short local war with Georgia, the reputation of its armed forces had suffered. During the campaign, considerable deficiencies in their organization and armament were revealed. Since then, Russia has engaged in a strong militarization program of the Southern Military District and Crimean Peninsula, becoming thus a power projection platform and marked the resumption of Moscow's strong rhetoric on the possibility of using nuclear capabilities, including by redeploying them to Crimea. Next slide. In the first stage, Moscow created a strong anti-access area denial, A2AD, to effectively cover the entire area of operations. And by annexing Crimea, was able to expand A2AD umbrella beyond the extended Black Sea region in order to provide quick response options in the event of an armed conflict. In fact, Russia's A2AD umbrella built on the Black Sea covers the entire eastern NATO flank, from Kola Peninsula to Crimea, being later extended with the air defense systems deployed in Syria. So, the Russian A2AD umbrella stretches from the Barents Sea to the eastern Mediterranean Sea. A2AD capabilities are further strengthened by the deployment of 222 M3 bombers in Crimea. During their missions, the strategic bombers are protected by Su-24 fighter jets, whose range covers almost the entire Black Sea waters. Thus, Russia established an interconnected and multi-layered air defense network between Crimea and southern military district, capable of facing any hostile military action inside A2AD umbrella. Next slide. The second line of effort is the modernization of the Black Sea naval forces, for which it was allocated $2.4 billion budget by 2020 for new generations of submarines and coastal defense systems. It is expected that 18 new naval units will be introduced in Black Sea fleet, most of which will be equipped with Kalibr missile systems. After the invasion of Crimea in 2014, Russia's strategic vision has shifted towards the historical ambition of accessing warm water ports. In this context, the Black Sea Fleet was assigned to augment the Permanent Naval Operation Task Force in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, which was re-established in 2013, and to contribute to the projection of the force and the influence in the Middle East and Africa. Usually, 10 to 15 naval units and support ships belonging to the Black Sea Fleet are deployed by rotation. Also, the command is provided by the Black Sea Fleet commander. Next slide, please. The Air Force was another line of effort characterized primarily by refurbishment in the first instance of the air bases and airfields in Crimea, as well as the deployment of new combat and air support capabilities from mainland Russia. The air component has been reinforced by the deployment on the peninsula of bomber, assault, fighter, and army aviation. Belbek and Gvardeyskoye airfields were reconstructed to accommodate Russian long-range bombers. On the slide, you have the 27th Mixed Aviation Division deployed in Crimea with three combat aviation brigades. Next slide, please. The Black Sea region is under the jurisdiction of the Southern Military District, one of the five military districts of the Russian Armed Forces. Although the smallest in surface area, it is responsible for vital areas for the Russian national security, and I mean Crimea, North Caucasus, Black Sea, and Caspian Sea. The Southern Military District's new 8th Combined Arms Army, established near the southern eastern borders of Ukraine, is still in the process of formation. It includes one motor rifle division, 150, and motor rifle brigade, the 20th, which might also be converted into the division in the future. At the end of 2016, the ground troops stationed in Crimea formed the 22nd Army Corps, subordinating to the Black Sea Fleet, and consistently upgraded its military capabilities over the past 60 years. It increased its military personnel from 12,000 to 32,000 this year, aiming to reach 43,000 by 2025. Also, the Russian military presence increased in Abkhazia and South Ossetia from 8,000 to 10,000 soldiers, and a large number of exercises estimated at about 130 per year take place mainly in South Ossetia. Next slide. It was also mentioned in the second panel. Also in the Black Sea, in 2017, a mobile electronic warfare system, Murmansk BN, was installed in Crimea, intended both for collecting signals and for jamming. Experts consider that the Russian initiative is mainly related due to the US and NATO ships' presence in the Black Sea. In the same year, a GPS spoofing attack was reported that involved 20 ships belonging to NATO in the Black Sea. Also, errors in the satellite navigation systems were reported and have led to the conclusion that Russian experiments with electronic warfare meant to either disrupt the trajectory of weapons using GPS guidance or to destabilize US drones flying in the Black Sea airspace. Next. The first Operation Strategic Command and Staff exercise with troops after the Cold War took place in 1999 and signaled that Russia must prepare for large-scale wars and regional military conflicts against a near-peer adversary. The resumption of the joint training through operational strategic exercises took also into account the lessons learned from NATO intervention in conflicts in the Balkans in the 90s, but also the aspiration of the former communist states to join NATO. In the Black Sea extended area, Caspian Sea included, in the Southern Military District area of responsibility, respectively, Russia exercises military operation on the southwestern strategic direction and in the northern Caucasus within the operational strategic exercise codenamed Kavkaz. The latest operational strategic command staff exercise, Kavkaz 2020, involves between 80,000 to 150,000 military personnel and covered all operational environments, land, air, sea, cyber, and electronic warfare. Next slide. Considering all the above mentioned aspects, Black Sea region remains a complicated and a volatile security environment. The geopolitical situation in the region is thus clear favorable to Russia, which together with a rapid process of augmentation and modernization of its military forces in the Black Sea region provides fertile ground to develop conventional and hybrid potential in order to achieve its political objectives. In conclusion, to counterbalance Russia's aggressive stance, an integrated approach is needed, both at the regional and allied levels, combining efforts to consolidate a credible and sustainable military deterrence posture, along with political and diplomatic concrete efforts and through a unitary, continuous, and coherent strategic communication. Thank you very much.
Thank you, General. Now we'll turn to Professor Dungaccio, who will take on the question of the frozen conflicts. And if I could ask the two remaining speakers to try to keep to 10 minutes so that we've got plenty of time for discussion. And if I could encourage the participants to start thinking about their questions and get them flowing. We've got a few, but I would like to see more. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Now, frozen conflicts, as the previous speaker has pointed out, frozen conflicts are part of the hybrid warfare, but they are more than that. And the main point of my presentation is that the frozen conflicts are the best instruments through which Russia can settle the strategic status of the territory between EU/NATO and Russia Federation, settling its advantage, of course. So this is the reason I think that we should approach, should deal with frozen conflicts are always about geopolitics, are always about the strategic projection of Russia outside its borders. Now, I will start with some general remarks and then to get into more concrete things. Now, the frozen conflicts, the protracted Soviet conflicts are unsurprisingly located in the strategically important area in the Black Sea, within the sovereign territories of the newly independent republics of Azerbaijan, Nagorno-Karabakh, Republic of Moldova, Transnistria, and more recently Ukraine, Donbass, or People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. Georgia, it's a different story because the Abkhazia and South Ossetia has been already recognized by Russia as sovereign and independent states. So the first observation is that it was a pattern. It was always something geopolitical. And whenever similar conflicts occur within the jurisdiction of the Russian Federation, they are described as rebellions or territories or terrorist activities, and they are dealt with ruthlessly, as in the case of the two Chechen wars. They are never frozen. The frozen conflicts never happen within the jurisdiction of Russian Federation. The second point, we are talking here about sort of internal conflicts with a historical background related to ethnicity and identity or political control that at some point degenerated into military confrontation or military confrontations. Whether it's evolved from the very beginning or not, Moscow then steps and secures a ceasefire or some other sort of interim arrangement, which stops the actual hostilities for a while but leaves the root causes untouched. Moscow's interest in generating and maintaining such simmering hotbeds of tension is to control the whole, these sovereign states or strategic spaces, by controlling a part, the conflict zone, in a classical story of the tail wagging the dog. And this is the essence of the frozen conflicts. What's the point to invade Ukraine if you can control the political or strategical decision of Ukraine controlling Donbas? What's the point to invade Republic of Moldova if you can control Republic of Moldova through Transnistria? So this is the whole story. Now, why should we talk about the frozen conflicts today? Well, for a couple of reasons. So the great power competition, it's an euphemism for US and China rivalry, of course. And pivot to Asia is not about if, but when. So EU is not a great power, Russia is not a great power anymore. But we know that Europe will become a secondary theater, militarily speaking, but it should be secure nevertheless. And the main strategic problem today is the strategic status of the territory between, again, NATO and Russia. This region has been once called the wider Black Sea region. If you remember the famous 24 article, Black Sea and the Frontiers of Liberty, issued by Ron Asmus and Bruce Jackson. And the Black Sea strategy apparently has been abandoned soon, 27. Now, in order to pivot to Asia, you have to settle this region one way or another. Could be a big bargain, diplomatic, whatever. But here are the issue of frozen conflicts. Because again, my point is that the frozen conflicts are very useful and very, very important instruments. Russia can use these instruments in order to get strategic advantages and to settle the strategic status of the region. Now, taking advantage of the sort of conflict fatigue or the lack of interest in the US or the fact that EU through either France or Germany, they go along with Russia in some dossiers. Russia wants to create a sort of Russia in, EU down and US out strategic space. And this is particularly evident in the insistence to legalize in Ukraine or Republic of Moldova, for example, a special status for separatist entities through constitutional amendments or other legal disposition that would give them de facto veto power or vital interests of foreign security policy at the national level. So the case is in point again, it's Ukraine and Republic of Moldova, the most significant frozen conflicts, and in my perception, the most important now today. Now let me get into some more concrete things. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh. If you look at Nagorno-Karabakh 30 years ago, it's obvious that frozen conflict was not from, Russia did not have from the beginning a sort of clear-cut strategy. It's obvious that they are a lesson learned. And Russia have learned very well how to handle these conflicts. In early 90s, was not able to get peacekeepers on the ground. But you know, if you look back, I mean, it compensated recently when Russia managed to get Russian military presence on the ground in Nagorno-Karabakh. It was a huge victory, a very significant victory for Russia. It's not about the military dimension. It's not only a military victory, it's also a cultural thing to have Russian troops on the ground. And in the former USSR, former Russian space, former Soviet space, this cultural dimension is very important. So you have to understand this cultural dimension in order to understand the politicians in this area. For them, it's very difficult to get rid of this Russian complex. And the presence of Russian troops are also significant politically, not only military. Republic of Moldova, the second frozen conflict, so to speak. Now, in the Republic of Moldova, they were not very good when they signed the peacekeeper. The peace treaty has been signed by Russia and Republic of Moldova. Now, in fact, Russia was part of the conflict at that time. And they somehow, in one way or another, they managed to change the narrative. And now when you're talking about the frozen conflict in Republic of Moldova, the two parts of Transnistria and Republic of Moldova, Russia somehow vanished, so they disappeared from the picture. And the main problem of Russia in Republic of Moldova is that to try to had to stop the NATO expansion or I don't know, Euro-Atlantic border to get to move forward. So it should block the Republic of Moldova not to get too close to EU, not to get too close to NATO, not to get too close to Romania. In Republic of Moldova, it's the identity dimension, it's essential because Republic of Moldova can get directly into NATO and EU through reunification with Romania. It's a German scenario. And Russians are very careful when they are looking at Republic of Moldova because the identity is far more important in Republic of Moldova than Ukraine. Than in Ukraine, because Ukraine does not have this theoretical, of course, opportunity. So in Ukraine, the Russians, they managed to get, you know, they use their diplomatic tools in a very effective way. In Ukraine, when you read the Minsk agreement, it's interesting that they managed to put the political conditions, the political solutions first and security solutions second. So, in other words, in Minsk agreements, the points 4, 8, 11, and 12 are about political solution, and the rest of the points from the agreement are security solution. In other words, they are asking officially to the Kiev to settle the political conflict first, so a sort of federalization or a special status for Donbas, and then to get the control of the Russian-Ukrainian border. So this in a frozen conflict is an essential thing, prioritization, who comes first, the political solution or the security solutions. And in Ukrainian conflict, in the frozen conflict in Donbas, I mean, the Russians really did an excellent job. So again, so it's not about that a sort of pattern. The Russians, you know, the way in which the Russians projecting themselves, they have, you know, a clear cut pattern and they're using the frozen conflict. They're using frozen conflicts, but there are a lot of lessons learned. And the Russians diplomats, unfortunately for the Western diplomats and for us, are very good in dealing with these files. Unfortunately, the Western diplomats are not very well prepared to face Russia in this respect. I'm not saying that they're interested or not, but basically, in fact, if you look at the documents from a technical point of view, see that the Russians, you know, they have a strategy and they know what they want. So the conclusion, very briefly. First, Russia is getting grounded in the region. Russia strategically has won the recent Nagorno-Karabakh conflict by imposing Russian peacekeeper troops on the ground, very significant thing. In Belarus, Russia has an upper hand, leaving Lukashenko without any options, of course, with the help of protesters. So Russia is very present and very effective. So despite what, well, sometimes we read in the Western newspapers, you know, Russia, it's, I think that Russia it's, would be at the end of the day, the winner in Belarus, strategically speaking. The third point, Republic of Moldova and Ukraine are in a very weak negotiation position. So when we're hearing about, you know, the 5+2 format or Normandian format, we have to be very careful because these countries are not able to protect themselves in front of such a pressure. So Normandian format is a strategic danger for Ukraine, and 5+2 format today is a strategic danger for Republic of Moldova. So this is very problematic, and I would say that we have to be a little more careful and more attentive to these developments. And the last point, look at what was happening in Republic of Moldova. The last phrase, Maia Sandu, pro-European, pro-US, trained in Harvard and very pro-European and very, you know, good side of the barricade. And even Maia Sandu assumed to some extent the Russian narratives as far as the frozen conflict in Russia is concerned. Kishinev is asking the withdrawing not of the Russian troops, but only the withdrawing of the operational group of Russian forces in Moldova, which is different. So Russia, officially Kishinev is making a distinction between operational group of Russian forces and so-called Russian peacekeepers. So this is something new, and it's very bad news that Maia Sandu, pro-European president, is assuming a narrative way, a Russian way of looking at the frozen conflict in Republic of Moldova. And I will stop here and looking forward for your questions or comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Now over to you, Harlan.
Thank you, and greetings to all from a very sunny, chilly day in Washington. I want to make three points. First point is that we have underestimated, in my judgment, the geostrategic relevance, not only of the Black Sea in Europe, but I think we've exaggerated in the great power competition, the role of China. And it seems to me that the way that one deals with China, interestingly, is going east through Europe all the way around, because that's where the centrality of our partnerships exist, and we tend to ignore that. And the other downside of a great power competition is historical. Great power rivalry started World War I, and what concerns me is it does not appear to be an off-ramp at this stage in the United States great power competition with China or Russia, nor are the aims or objectives of competing, deterring, and defeating sufficiently described. Second, it strikes me that we have entered a brand new strategic era. And thirdly, I want to talk about how do we deal with this era and put in place much more cost-effective military and political solutions to deal with Russia in particular, but also China. I would argue that we have reached a strategic inflection point, probably as great as nuclear weapons, in that the new strategic paradigm, it seems to me, is represented by massive attacks of disruption. Indeed, we have to deal, obviously, with great powers and small powers and non-state actors. But the advent of the coronavirus and COVID was a massive disruption for which we were entirely unprepared. And I believe that this disruption really is the precursor of even far greater potential disruptions. I will just list a couple of them and then go on to solutions that I think are important. The first and most dangerous, in my judgment, which is reflected in the United States, is failed and failing government. If we cannot agree on what we need to do at home, how can we possibly agree what we're going to do abroad? Secondly, climate change. Climate change has been underestimated, it seems to me, because there are just too many climate deniers. But this could be perhaps even far more disruptive as we see the Arctic ice melt, as we see sea levels rising, as we see storms intensifying, as we see fires and droughts breaking out. I also would argue that other issues such as drones, particularly cyber and social media, as well as debt and terror, are the new disruptors about which we need to think, and that dealing only with Russia or China or non-state actors will be insufficient to deal with our security in the future, in which a new fifth horseman, in my judgment, has arisen, armed with this weapon of mad, massive attacks of disruption that has replaced the Cold War mutual assured destruction. And unless or until we understand that we have to have far broader solutions and strategies, I'm afraid we're going to be playing with 20th century ideas in a 21st century world. Now, what needs to be done in my judgment? First, I believe that NATO's strategy, and indeed America's strategy, is still very much built on 20th century concepts and 20th century industrial age capacities as opposed to 21st century information technologies. In other words, the way that the future is going to be battled over, in my mind, is going to be less with traditional conventional forces as we have known them, tanks, aircraft, ships, et cetera, and more with battles in cyberspace, perceptual battles, political battles, and psychological and ideological battles. Now, in my mind, NATO's strategy in Europe should have three objectives. The first is to contain Russian expansion ideologically, physically, politically, and otherwise. Second, we need to be able to defend, and I will go into my ideas about a porcupine defense. And thirdly, and probably most importantly, despite what happened in Ukraine in 2014, we have to engage. Russia and the West have mutual interests, from arms control to climate change, to dealing with terrorism, to instabilities elsewhere, and indeed to global economic issues that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. And so engagement has to be much higher. Now, how would a porcupine defense work, particularly in the Black Sea region? The idea of a porcupine defense, as with a porcupine, and for those in Northern Europe, let's say hedgehogs, is that with all the bristles and spines of a porcupine, you really don't want to pet one. And the notion here is that if Russia were looking to expand either through active measures or physically, it would be presented with such huge costs that it would not indeed even contemplate the idea of using force in the first place. Now, what would this look like? First of all, in the Black Sea, it seems to me that we need to be able to disrupt, confuse by using misinformation, disinformation, and deception what any kind of a Russian attack might look like, to decapitate it and focus on their command and control. We can do this with a huge array of electronic type warfare systems, information systems, cyber systems, and the like, to make, in essence, an electronic porcupine that would be very difficult to penetrate. Second, we need to put in place particular obstacles. There have been arguments for a long time for huge IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in the neighborhood of 20,000 tons in huge vans and trailers, strategically placed on borders so that if the Russians were to come across, it would be a very, very unhappy circumstance. I also believe in the Black Sea that local submarines are far more important than surface forces, especially with the Montreux Convention. And so it seems to me that Romania in particular would be far better advised in buying new frigates to think about several submarines which could do enormous amounts of damage. Next, we need to be able to reach out and touch not only Ukraine, but Crimea. At this stage, we don't have any weapon systems really, aside from a few aircraft. And so that missiles are really necessary to be able to have the reach of 400 or 500 miles to be able to threaten not only Crimea, but the Black Sea fleet. Next, I think that drones are certainly the weapons of the future. If you see how they've been utilized in Syria and Nagorno-Karabakh, that armed with literally tens of thousands of drones, which can be manufactured very inexpensively, it seems to me that this could either overwhelm and certainly disrupt any kind of a potential attack simply by these massive swarm uses of drones. I also believe that new systems in terms of command and control and certainly search and reconnaissance can be found in both aerostats and lighter than air vehicles, once called blimps, which because of the way of their surface contour can be used for mounting various radars that have both an anti-submarine non-acoustical ability, but also the ability to look deep and to be able to detect ships, surface ships and aircraft, and are not very, very expensive. On top of that, you're going to need to have more low Earth orbiters that can be put into space very, very quickly, because no doubt space will be targeted. And the whole doctrine here is really to fight a major guerrilla war, if necessary, with reserve forces, so that the Russians, if they were even contemplating an attack, would have to get through these huge barriers of missiles, of drones, of standoff weaponry, of huge IEDs, and then confront, in essence, a partisan army. And I think that the way the Russian battle groups have been organized, I think that they tend to be largely inflexible. And I certainly believe that command and control can be interrupted. Now, let me make one final comment about the notion of emerging disruptive technologies. I think this is a false label. Technologies have always been disruptive. World War I, battlefields were transformed basically from sea and land environments to air with aircraft, to submarines and subsurface, to the ether with cyber warfare and electronic warfare, and finally with weapons of mass destruction. So I think before we launch on this notion of these hugely disruptive technologies, it does us well to go back and remind ourselves historically that nuclear weapons were extremely disruptive, that smart and precision weapons and standoff and deep attack were also quite disruptive. And I think that this is not necessarily a step function, but it certainly is a range of technologies that certainly can be used in what I call porcupine defense. A final point is this. One of the aspects of the porcupine defense, and one of the issues I think NATO has to take far more seriously, is preventing active measures. The Russians have been brilliant in using active measures offensively. And in our case on the West, I think we have not been very good in responding in terms of their propaganda, disinformation, and misinformation. For example, there's very good evidence to suggest that in the Brexit vote in 2016, in addition to the Conservative Party using social media to try to influence some 2 million Brits who had not affiliated themselves with political parties, the Russians were doing even a better job in the Leave campaign. And similarly, you have seen what Russia has been doing and interfering in not only in American elections, but in Europe. And so I think part of the porcupine defense is a far greater and more robust counter active measures defense, which deals obviously with cyber, deals with social media. And it's an area in which I believe that we have not done very well and where we have to invest more heavily. In terms of budgets, given what the impact of Corona will be on defense budgets and indeed on economies, my guess is that this sort of defense that I've argued can be done at far less expense. It's going to move away from the industrial age notion of the importance of platforms to the information 21st century age of information of zeros and ones and electrons, in which the nature of how you transmit that kind of weaponry is far more important than the type of platform that you choose to do it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Harlan. That was a certainly a very broad sweep of the environment that we face. Now, we've got a number of questions that have come in, but before I turn to those, let me use my privilege as chairman to raise a couple of points with the panel. The first is Turkey. None of you mentioned Turkey, but Turkey was mentioned by General Petrescu in the first session, where he commented on the good relations between the Romanian military and the Turkish military. But how do you see Turkey playing into this environment that you've described? And what are the prospects for a cohesive approach by the states excluding Russia, which border the Black Sea? That's a question probably principally for our two Romanian friends, but if Harlan wants to tackle it as well, that's fine. But I have another question that I think is more directed at him, which is on timescales and, you know, how you would recommend that the strategy that you're describing is implemented. What sort of organizational structures do you think might be needed? So I think we start with Leonardo.
Thank you. I'm looking from the military balance in the region, and Russia in the region has only one rival from military point of view, which is Turkey. We have to look back into history. So I didn't find in the history a time when Russia and Turkey were friends. So we have to keep in mind the Crimean Wars and lately what happened in the Second World War. In the nowadays, and we have to recall the 2015. When Turkey shot down a Russian airplane, and some everything has changed between the two the regional powers. You remember that it was a huge debate, and Russia took immediate measures, banned the exports to Russia, banned the workers to go to Russia for the gas pipelines, banned interdict the Russians to go for the in holidays in Turkey. Immediately, Turkey asked for apologize, and everything changed. Syria become a ground a place to accommodate the two interests. Turkey, in order to solve their national security interest against the YPG and PKK. And they started to communicate. But in my and later on, we have to keep in mind also what happened when the Syrian air forces. But I strongly believe that with the support of Russian, because the air defense in Syria was provided by Russians, killed 33 Turkish soldiers. And the last one, and Professor Dungacu mentioned it, in Nagorno-Karabakh. So now we have a joint peacekeeping, a so-called joint peacekeeping center in Nagorno-Karabakh with 2,000 Russian soldiers and some Turkish military. In my opinion, it's a so-called gentleman agreement based on nowadays national interests of Turkey and Russia. But there will be no love forever between these two states. And Turkey plays a major role in the security of the region. General Petrescu mentioned it. At the beginning, they didn't want to be involved. Turkey is not happy. Turkey is not happy what happened with Crimea and the fate of Crimean Tatars in that region. But they accepted because they want, in the first instance, to solve their problems in eastern Turkey and in Syria and in northern Iraq. Turkey, it's a powerful NATO member and must be engaged through communication. They changed a little bit their position in the last year. And General Petrescu mentioned they joined the Romanian initiatives at the Black Sea. And step by step, I think, through dialogue and diplomacy, we can bring back Turkey. Thank you.
Yeah, Professor Dungacu.
Yeah, just a couple of points. In this region, there are two nations with imperial memories. The first one is Russia, the second one is Turkey. So very difficult to deal with them both. So the main problem with Turkey is that there is a resurrection of imperial memory and also of Turkish nationalism, which is it's very difficult to reconvert, because nationalism, we don't know what Turkey will do in the future, but it's obvious that something very significant is going on in Turkey, from Hagia Sophia, the Christian church, turned into mosque, to, I don't know, keep Turkish peacekeepers to Azerbaijani. I mean, there is a connection here. And Turkey wants to be present everywhere. The Turkish wants to be, I don't know, respected. Okay, their definition of respect. The main problem is that we don't know what will happen with Turkey in the future, but we have to know that all the deals that Turkey is making now, it's only for a very short period of time, so to speak. It's obvious that they don't like Russians. It's obvious that they would want to get more power in the Black Sea region. But in the same time, it's not only about Russia. I'm pretty sure that the Turks don't like at all the fact that US administration or Obama administration has worked with the Kurds. If you look from this perspective, the Kurds issue, it's an existential geopolitics for Turkey. It's not geopolitical as such, it's existential. It's about the Turkish territory and so forth and so on. And if you look at the surveys in Turkey, the attitude towards US, the anti-Americanism in Turkey, it's increasing. And it's increasing for these particular reasons, because they perceive, you know, the US as a sort of existential threat for them, which is worse than Russia, because the Russians are not going with, they're not going along or are not supporting the Kurds, you know, to dismantle the Turkey territories. I'm not saying that they are right or wrong. What I'm saying is that they have to, you cannot expect that Turkey will reject, you know, 100% Russia, and they will embrace, I don't know, Europe or US. when you have a Turkey which is resurrection, it's in a sort of resurrection, national resurrection, try to define themselves in a very religious, in the same time religious and ethnically, which is something new, well, we have to expect that they will play with all the significant actors, but you don't have to expect that Turkey will, I don't know, will go along with Russians, or will go along with US, or will go along with the Europeans. For us, we are in a very complicated position. Turkey is a strategic partner for Romania. We hope that we will be able to keep Turkey as close as possible to NATO and to, I don't know, Euro-Atlantic perspective on Black Sea region. It's not very easy. But the problem is not only Russia. Again, the problem is EU, the attitudes of EU towards Turkey, or the attitudes, the way in which US is dealing with Turkey. Is the main. So don't look at it, Russia, only at Russia. Don't look to the Brussels and look to DC, to Washington, in order to understand what is happening as far as the Turkey is concerned, because Turkey is in completely different logic that Romania or Bulgaria or other countries. It's in a sort of resurrection, and it used to be an empire, very complicated to deal with such so-called nation states.
Dan, thank you. But what about the scope for wider cooperation by the states around the Black Sea?
Well, the main problem is that we look at the Black Sea, we cannot look together in the same direction. Romanians, Bulgarians, and the Turks, they are not able to go to Washington, for example, and to say, this is our perspective on the Black Sea region. But you have to have in mind that the Black Sea region, it's a, there are two perspectives, basically. One perspective is that the Black Sea region should belong to the riverine countries. And you have the formal expression of this perspective in the Black Sea Economic Cooperation Institution, which was based on the idea that Black Sea should belong to the riverine states. A different perspective is that Black Sea should be an open in. This was the famous debate, you know, in 1936 at Montreux Convention. So basically it was a confrontation because the Brits and the, I don't know, the locals, Soviets and Turks and Romanian, unfortunately. The famous Romanian diplomat, Titulescu, was, you know, he was on the, I'm not sure that on a good side of the story. And they, you know, the convention, the Montreux Convention, the expression of this perspective. Romania now has a different perspective. Romania, it wants to see a Black Sea as an open sea to let, you know, the NATO troops get in, the US, Great Britain, EU, and so on and so forth. The Bulgarians are not very convinced. And the Turks are completely opposed to this position. So they want the Black Sea, and they have a similar position to the Russians. They want the Black Sea to belong to the riverine states, and they have to have control. Romania wants that the Black Sea should be an open sea to let Westerners to get in particular US. And the Bulgarians, they want to see not, they look at the Black Sea from a touristic perspective. They don't want to see, I don't know, US float or flotilla and whatever. They don't care too much. They're in between. So basically we don't have a position. So the Black Sea from this perspective, the Black Sea is very complicated to deal with, because even the NATO members, which are riverine states, the Black Sea, they're not able to concept of what Black Sea should be in the future. So this is the huge difference from the Black Sea to the Baltic Sea, for example. In the Baltic Sea, it's far more coherent. And of course, we are not very happy with the fact that, you know, in the Baltic, you have enhanced presence and in Black Sea, only tailored presence of NATO. And all these things, you know, if you put them together, you realize that, yeah, it's, Black Sea is not Baltic, unfortunately, so not yet.
Thanks for that. It's a it's a nice way to feed into the point that I was wanting Harlan to address, which is the, you know, how to go about the porcupine strategy. And I'm going to add to that a question from General Philip Breedlove, who has greeted you and says, is there an application for porcupine defense when it comes to Russia's hybrid war machine?
First, a comment about Turkey. I think, Tom, on the current trajectory, Turkey is a huge disruptor. And on the current trajectory, I would not be surprised to see it withdraw from the military committee of NATO. And it seems to me that the best way to get to Turkey is through Russia. The better relations with Russia and the West, it seems to me less pressure is put on Turkey. As far as General Breedlove's question, obviously the porcupine is directed entirely against the hybrid offensive of Russia. And indeed, there is a maritime version in China. The way that we have to go about this is similar to the way that stealth and deep strike were developed. When Jim Schlesinger was Secretary of Defense in the early 70s, somebody came to him and said, would you like an airplane that's not detectable by radar? And when deep strike was put in place, the idea was, how deeply can we strike with these weapons? I think that the only way that Porcupine is going to become successful is through a few war games with great specificity. For example, I think that NATO and NATO members ought to be doing a war game in which they have to face budget cuts of 25%. What are they going to do under those circumstances to get the mindset changed? And I think NATO needs to do a war game against the Black Sea, in a Black Sea contingency or Baltic or High North, when you're equipped with 10,000 or 20,000 drones. How would that really change the order of battle? And it seems to me by using these kinds of war games, a lot of information is going to come out that we don't have right now. Now, the fundamental problem, obviously, is that our strategies are entirely different. They're based on big platforms. The defense industrial base is really good at building big platforms like ships, airplanes, aircraft carriers. And unfortunately, they are going to be too expensive, and I believe they're going to be too cumbersome to deal with war in the electronic age. And of course, they will be a very fierce block because they're not very good at making lots of small things. They're very good at making a few very expensive things. So the only way we're going to be able to get there is to challenge the defense intellectual base and to challenge the military to say, look, your budget has just been cut by 25% or 30% or even more draconian. What are you going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? And just don't complain. And secondly, here's a war game. The Russians are coming west, trying to get into Romania. They're trying to get through the Black Sea. Now the Romanians and the Bulgarians or even the Turks have got 20,000 drones. How would that play out? And so I think by making these points where everybody takes a look at this and says, I wish I had thought about that, as dramatic as telling Jim Schlesinger, would you like an airplane invisible to radar, or can we strike the Soviets deeply? I think by looking at a few technologies and putting them in war games under the threat, the Damoclean threat of budget cuts, I think you're going to have to change people's thinking. That will lead to a different strategic concept, certainly in NATO. And I hope in the United States, with the new administration, we will also be open to looking at new and different ways to deal with providing for the common defense, because right now, what we have is unaffordable, in my judgment.
Thank you very much for that, Harlan. I'm going to pick up a couple of questions that have come in, one of which touches on a point that that Dan drew attention to. This is the question of the different relationships that exist amongst the NATO allies in the Baltic region by comparison with the Black Sea. And Laurentio Paciu asks whether, in your view, which of those two regions entail a higher confrontational risk? And, you know, does that depend on your assumptions about how Russia views the two regions and which one it wishes to be most confrontational in? So I think I'll start with Leonardo, if I may, and then ask the others to chip in.
It's a very good question. So if you remember, if you can recall my last slide, Russia is not looking to two different directions. Russia is looking towards NATO's entire flank. We are looking differently from military point of view and geopolitical point of view, even from military strategy point of view, because the northern flank has an opening. You can act with armor, tanks, and heavy machinery. In the south, you have the sea, and it's a different military approach. But Moscow is looking to the entire front entirely. For this reason, they have a single command for the Baltic Fleet and Black Sea Fleet. It's one commander in Moscow. There are no two commanders. The exercises are connected and interconnected. So in my opinion, Russia is not looking to two different theaters. They are looking what NATO is doing to the entire NATO flank. Of course, from operational point of view, there are two strategic directions that, from the Russian point of view, the northern strategic direction and southwestern strategic direction. So in my opinion, we need, and we started, Romania started to promote this in Brussels, that we have to address the threat, the Russian threat, integrated from north to south.
May I?
It's important. This is in the north you have enhanced forward presence, in the south you have tailored forward presence, and maybe this is also, in my point of view, it's a vulnerability, because Russia already knows that the most powers are concentrated in the north, and the southern we are weaker. Thank you.
Dan, have you got any thoughts on this? And let me just add another question, which I've spotted from Valentin Berka, who says, does the Three Seas Initiative have the prospect of strengthening security in the Black Sea region?
Now, first point to continue what have been said. Well, unfortunately, at the level of Eastern Front or the Eastern Flank, I mean, it's problematic. It's an Eastern Front or an Eastern Flank. But the problem is that we do not have, when they're looking to the Eastern Flank, this the same view, in the sense that we do not accept that we have one front, one army, one enemy. So I completely agree with what the General Dean has said. So the difference between the Baltics region and the Black Sea region, and it's not a very good idea, I would say. The second point, well, let me say this. In early 90s, he had Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, and Lithuania. In Estonia, 40% Russians. Latvia, 30% Russians. Lithuania, 10, 12% Russians. How comes that in these countries, in early 90s, Russia did not try to create a sort of federations, as it tries to create now in Ukraine or Republic of Moldova, based on idea that there are many Russians are living there and so on and so forth. Again, 40% Russians in Estonia, 30% in Latvia, 10% in Lithuania. So basically the idea is that the Russians from the beginning have looked at the Baltic region as a region which is, so to speak, different from Russia, and is not necessarily a sort of as near abroad as the Black Sea region is. So basically the cultural perspective and the perception was different. So the Russians, they were not, I mean, they even tried to create federations in Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania in order to keep these countries and to block these countries and to dismantle, you know, the Euro-Atlantic path of this of this of these countries. So my feeling is that the Black Sea, when they are looking at the Black Sea region, they have the feeling that the Black Sea region is more theirs than the Baltic Sea. So they are entitled to do whatever they want. I mean, they are entitled to control the Black Sea region or to be, I don't know, the main power in the Black Sea region. This is also, this is a matter of perception. But unfortunately, we do not have this perception when looking to the Black Sea region. We don't feel in the same way. And this is the explanation for the differentiation between the tailored and enhanced presence. But the Russians are looking the completely, historically speaking, culturally speaking, politically speaking, when they're looking at the Black Sea region, they're looking at the Baltic region, they are looking at completely two different realities. The Baltic is part of the Black Sea, it's there, I don't know, the background. And okay, that's it. So, thank you. I will stop here.
And what about the Three Seas Initiative?
Three?
The Three Seas Initiative?
There are two dimensions. Well, it's an economical dimension, the Three Seas Initiative, and the Bucharest format, which is dealing with security in more, I don't know, a military and security dimension. Well, Three Seas Initiative, it would not change the attitude of the riverine country of the Black Sea, unfortunately. It's very good because it helped the region to develop itself, to get more connected. And it's very important to get the north of the eastern flank to the south. It's very important. But as far as the Black Sea region is concerned, unfortunately, they would not be very helpful in order to help us and the Bulgarians and the Turks to stay at the same table and to try to do something together coherent for us and for our partners, NATO, EU, or US. So it's good. I completely agree that it could be helpful, but strategically speaking, I'm not very optimistic.
Thanks for that. Now, Harlan, have you got reflections on this point that's been brought up now once or twice about the distinction between the enhanced forward presence and the tailored forward presence?
Yeah, I think it's a huge mistake. Look, we're not very good understanding the Soviet Union. We had no idea it was going to implode. And I think that we have overly militarized the relationship with Russia because of what happened in Ukraine. If you go back and read, and you won't, Putin's millennial address as 1999 became 2000, and the Munich speech in its entirety, it is absolutely clear what Putin was worried about. Russia was surrounded, and he was afraid that Russia really had the risk of imploding. And I'm not trying to apologize for what Russia has done, but we have, I think, overly militarized the situation. Russia has no, let me say that again, has no intention of starting a war. The notion they're going to march through the Baltics is just nonsense. They learned their lesson in World War II, and they don't have the capacity. Where they do have a capacity, however, is through active measures. And what they have done, and I would argue this is not an A2AD defense, it's much more of a defensive offensive mindset. They have, in essence, tried to propose a Monroe Doctrine to seal off the possibility of further intrusions or interventions. And we don't understand that. And so we have to take advantage of their strategic view, and we've not done that. And in terms of, I think, how we have, as I said, over-militarized, worried about this nonsense in the Baltic of a Russian invasion, and we have underestimated the strategic importance to Russia of the Black Sea, in part because only four NATO nations are riparian states, if you include Greece, and virtually every country in NATO is somehow dealing with the Black Sea or the entrance to the Black Sea, at least the major countries of Northern Europe. About the Three Seas Initiative, if this were done seriously, it could have tremendous strategic impact two ways. One, if you dredge the Baltic to 4 or 5 meters, you could make Constanta the biggest seaport in the world with enormous implications, I should say in Europe, with enormous implications. And if you can deal with the pipelines, you'll be able to increase energy security. That again would be something strategically with Russia. So the geoeconomic and strategic aspects of the three C's, if it could be done, are very, very real. The problem is that Bulgaria and other states object to the dredging of the Blacks of the Danube, which is an issue. But my point is, if we take a look at Russian strategy, the Russian view of its own needs for defense, and then construct our strategy against that, instead of a Western interpretation of what we think it is, I think we'd end up to a more balance between the various high north, the Baltics, and the Black Sea, with greater emphasis in the Black Sea. And one way to do that is to begin developing the porcupine defense in that particular region.
Thank you very much for that. We're getting close to our allotted time, but there's a few points that I'd like to bring up. One is from Doru Kostia, who says, given that neither Russia nor Turkey have a particularly spectacular economic performance, do the panelists think that this might cause them to reconsider their strategy and choose economic cooperation, both with each other and with the riparian states, I think is the idea. There's a question from Hans-Peter Mittun, who says, is the description of frozen conflict misleading, given that in hybrid or gray area warfare, and picking up Harlan's point, really, the confrontation is going on all the time. One question from Achilleus at Sirgis, who says, is it possible that now that Russia has consolidated its presence in its base in Tartus in Syria, that would ease some of the pressure in the Black Sea area? I'm going to start with you, General. You can pick up any or all of these. It's up to you.
So for the first question, what Professor Dongaccio said, we have two former imperial states, Russia and former Ottoman Empire. So I believe that they will not get rid of using the military power in order to obtain political and economic objectives, and we have seen what they have done till now. Yes, they are looking for economic opportunities. We have seen Turkey, because of the EU problems, focusing on the Middle East. We've seen Russia also looking for other opportunities. But also what I have to mention, and it's very important, I want to underline, that in this coherent environment, and you mentioned about the Three C's initiative, I agree what Dr. Ullmann said. If we not provide a coherent message in all domains, political, military, economic, social, information, all these initiatives doesn't matter so much. I didn't think that I get very
I think, General, I will have to cut you off there because I'm being asked to bring this to a conclusion. But if I can ask Dan and then Harlan just for, say, 30 seconds each on last concluding thoughts, and then we'll end this session.
The first point is, to go back to what General Ullmann have said about the Monroe Doctrine. I mean, it's obvious that we are going back to my previous points. The strategic status of the territory between Russia and EU/NATO. We don't have a common vision that we have to deal with it. The second point about the frozen conflict, of course, the conflicts are never frozen. Yeah, they're not. The mischaracterization of the Western mischaracterization, I would say, because conflict conservation, the factor, it's based on the Russian terms. and it became a sort of Western diplomacy fallback option instead of conflict resolution on Western terms. And from the Western point of view, frozen is very comfortable to say that the conflict it's frozen. It means that you don't have to get in. So let them there, let the Russians deal with the frozen conflict. So in this respect, it's an ideological perception. And I completely agree, the conflict has never frozen. And there are many arguments for that, but unfortunately, I don't have time to get into maybe to the
thank you
next,
for that.
Next seminar, Dan. Thank you.
Harlem?
Let me conclude. First, we've got to be clever. We have to be able to energize, I think, innovative diplomacy. Why don't we think about changing the Montreux Convention, namely because Russia was never a signatory, the Soviet Union was, in Ukraine and Georgia were not independent states. Now, that's not going to happen, but that will certainly send shockwaves that we possibly could put to good use. Second, I think we have to realize that I think we're over-exaggerating the military threat from Russia. I would argue that the arrival of this fifth horseman and massive attacks of disruption, whether from climate change or social media or cyber, are going to be far more important, as we've seen with the pandemic. And we can do both. We talk about dual use technologies. We ought to have dual use strategies in which, where we protect our physical security against Russia or China militarily, we're also doing it, protecting our security against these attacks of disruption. It's going to take a huge intellectual and political sea change. But I think that this is a new era, and we have to address it with 21st century ideas and not concepts of the past which may not fit.
Thank you very much for that, Harlan. Well, it just leaves me to say that the big takeaway that I got out of this is we need to think about the security not so much as one affecting the North and another one affecting the southeast, but think of it more coherently, and perhaps also introduce completely new concepts of how we deal with this situation, as has been suggested. I thank you very much to all the panelists, and now I'll hand over to Ambassador Sergio Kelak, who is going to give the concluding remarks.
I hope you hear me. It would be, I think, too presumptuous, even indecent of me to try to draw any meaningful conclusions from a debate which has been informative, substantial, both in terms of contribution by keynote speakers and in the quality of questions and responses to them. They speak for themselves. We shall all have an opportunity to take another look at the notes we have been taking, and we shall rediscover the wealth of information, thoughtful analysis, and forward thinking that has emerged from our talk today. I am happy to report, in my capacity as editor at this time, that we have a new baby at the new strategy center. This is a collection of 25 essays, 321 pages in total, by authors from three continents, including four of the speakers that appear in the discussion today. It has a foreword by Ambassador Wolfgang Ischinger of Germany, the president of the Munich Security Conference, And then afterwards, by Ambassador Mircea Joana, a Romanian, who is the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. We are doubly happy at the New Strategy Center that this publication comes into the world on the fifth anniversary of our foundation as the think tank. And I'll, for those who are less familiar with who we are, I would like to say just a couple of words about who the those people at the New Strategy Center are, and what this association looks like. It is a nonpartisan think tank, which is financially independent and politically ecumenical. We have on our scientific board four former foreign ministers of Romania, two former national security advisors to two very different presidents of Romania, and four retired generals or admirals. We are not keen to pull rank by describing the composition of our board, but just to suggest the quality of experience and deeper thinking that we are able and have proved in the past 5 years to be able to put on the table. Now, just a few words about the takeaways from this conference, without any ambition to make sure that I'm able to focus on what is really essential. I think that the discussion was immensely useful for our better understanding of both the similarities and the distinctions between the security concerns in the two areas at the extreme of flank, or eastern flank of NATO in the north and in the south. In fact, much has been said this afternoon about the differences between the content of the threats, challenges and opportunities on the northern flank, northern tier of the eastern flank versus the southern one. So I would not repeat that. But what has appeared as a common trend in the speakers of at this conference is that we are in both those tiers of the eastern flank, we are taking Russia's assertiveness and dangerously expensive military buildup seriously. We have also agreed on the importance of NATO in the newly prevailing geostrategic circumstances, and that the report of the Reflection Group for NATO 2030 contains quite a number of useful recommendations for our decision makers, political decision makers, to think of. It also transpired throughout the debate that the transatlantic link is sound and solid, and may have received a new lease on life as a result of the recent presidential elections in the United States. The statesmen made so far about by President-elect Joe Biden about NATO and the future US attitude towards its allies are certainly reassuring, as are also the appointments, or rather nominations, for the top positions in the White House and in the cabinet for the next administration. Just one or two days ago, we had good news from Poland, which is a pivotal country on the eastern flank. Together, I would say, modestly, with Romania in the southern tier. The news was about the inauguration of the Forward headquarters, responding to a long-standing insistence by the Polish government to have a substantial NATO and in particular United States presence on Polish soil. This is good news because we can now aspire for a comparatively attentive approach to the southern tier and to Romania in particular. Speaking about the southern tier, it is probably important that Foreign Minister Bogdan Aurescu, recently backed by a letter signed by 10 incumbent foreign ministers in the region, brought again the subject of frozen conflicts, which were amply discussed today, on the table for both NATO and the European Union. As a long delayed subject that needs attention and probably also political, diplomatic, and other action by the NATO and European Union allies. And that idea may become an important subject for the future development of the Romania-US strategic partnership. We are concluding a difficult and eventful year for all of us. And 2021, which is just weeks away, promises to be even busier. We were happy to work together. We have established solid partnerships with both NUPI and the London School of Economics ideas. And we look forward to do some more work together. It is our accepted duty or curse, if you wish, to provide our respective decision makers with reasonable and meaningful food for thought in their decisions. After all, that's precisely what we have been invented for. Thank you.